Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Fanalytics Podcast. Mike Lewis, Doug Battle, brought to you by the Emory Marketing Analytics Center. Doug, right out the gate, I want to hit you with a little light economic theory. Sometimes I'm in the mood for a little more academic turn to at least start the show. You ready for that?
Hit me with it, Mike.
So I was looking at college basketball pages on ESPN, the men's page and the women's page, and they're really different. The women's page is all about Caitlin Clark,
yeah,
Angel Reese. Let me see, what are the Paige Buchers, Cameron Brink, being hailed as the Fab Four of women's college basketball. Three pictures of Caitlin Clark on the essentially the main page, two of Angel Reese. The men's page, it's all about the teams. It's a feature of Kansas, Arizona, Duke,
yeah,
MSU, a little bit of a profile about the new Georgetown coach. And it struck me as like it's an interesting kind of set of editorial decisions, right? Emphasizing the stars versus emphasizing the teams and the brands.
Right.
And I don't know what to make of it. So it's like I got two explanations. I will also say on the main page, the woman's sort of top teams little article is positioned exactly above the men's top team articles. So they have established a bit of a precedence there.
Okay? Hierarchy.
A hierarchy. Now, by way of background, you're too young for this. I tend to think that men's college basketball largely built ESPN. I mean, if you go back to the 1980s, that was like their main source of content. It was Dick Vitale and Duke basketball, big Mondays with a Big Ten matchup to start, and then a Big East and then a Big Ten matchup. But it appears that they've made an editorial decision to almost de-emphasize men's college basketball. And so some of this seems to be, look, we got to be honest, right? There's always this push for more women's sports and more editorial content. But on the other side of it, has the NBA sort of put in a position where, in the transfer portal and NIL, where there are no stars in men's college basketball, right? Because you got to remember, the women have to stay for 4 years. They can't leave early. The men, they move around constantly. They leave as soon as they can. And so I find it a very strange set of circumstances, but maybe it actually makes economic sense.
Yeah, it's kind of that NBA versus MLB approach. MLB, it's all about the Red Sox and the Yankees or the Dodgers, the Atlanta Braves, the marquee teams. The emphasis is always on the team brands. Teams seem like they've been around for forever. Men's college basketball, that's the approach. Duke, North Carolina, Arizona's been getting a lot of buzz. Kansas. I mean, you'll hear about UCLA every year. Even you mentioned Georgetown, who hasn't been particularly relevant, but they are one of those brands that's been a major part of college basketball for a long time. And more so, if the MLB approach is men's college basketball, I would say the NBA approach is women's college basketball, where the focus is on this. It's about LeBron. It's about Giannis. It's about Victor Wembanyama. It's about Luka Doncic. It's about Caitlin Clark. It's about Angel Reese. And so the women's college basketball taking that approach, it does make sense given that they have time to build those brands, those individual brands. Men's college basketball, with the exception of, like, I was watching Arizona last week and it was like, is that the kid from North Carolina playing? Yeah. So there's some kids that they build their brands, but it might be at different schools, but not a lot of the top talents stick around. And obviously it's not the case with women's college basketball. Potentially, I imagine someone like Caitlin Clark is out earning just about anyone in the WNBA with NIL. Could be wrong there. That's just...
Okay, hold on. Let me tell you something.
Yep.
Haley Cavender. Remember the Cavender twins from...
Yep.
What was
yep.
Miami. Yeah, but where was it before Miami, right? It was...
Arizona State?
No, it was... I think it was even like Cal State kind of school.
Okay. Or the show.
They moved to Miami for explicitly NIL money. They then came out this last year and said they were retiring, which was amusing, and had some deals with the WWE and some other places. Well, Haley Cavender to TCU. And so
what?
I suspect
when did this
you're
happen?
Right. I saw it today. So I suspect that you're right, that oddly the economics of this woman's game are so different that it's been reported that Angel Reese was making more than $1 million. I'm not sure how that makes economic sense, but maybe Caitlin Clark is making $1 million, $2 million. And there's going to be a dramatic pay cut once they leave these established platforms and have to, you know, function in the WNBA. So I think you're right. There may be 5 or 10 players that are making more in the college ranks than they will make in the WNBA.
So I typed in the first name of a WNBA player I could think of, which was Aja Wilson for the Aces. And big WNBA guy. And Aja Wilson, her annual contract is a little bit under $200,000 a year. So she recently signed a two-year, $398,000 contract with the Aces. It seems like these college young ladies are making a lot more than that. If the Cavender, did you say the Cavenders were making or Angel Reese was making $1 million to average like 6 points a game or something?
All this NIL stuff is so fuzzy, right? It's so dark in terms of, you know, understand what's happening, but it's been reported that they were making, Angel Reese was in that $1 million range, and I assume that means Caitlin Clark is being slotted in above that.
Yeah, so I think for women athletes, it's almost kind of amazing though. You would think if you're a Caitlin Clark, I think Caitlin Clark's going to change the game in a lot of ways, but you go to the NBA, even if you're making $200,000 a year or whatever, $200,000 in 2 years. I don't know what a rookie contract looks like, but you would think that those NIL deals would carry over, right? Like, are you no longer a marketing asset when you're a professional?
Okay. And so this is, I think, a point that I think everyone gets, but no one wants to admit. So is Angel Reese or Caitlin Clark moving product? I suspect that they might have the potential to do it, but I haven't seen them on ads. And if they are on ads, are they sort of bundled with a bunch of other celebrities, right? So what is the actual marketing appeal of the, look, Michael Jordan can move Gatorade, right? We get right. that. But there's a lot of these deals that probably are impossible to prove that the athlete is actually moving products. So it seems like the money comes from, well, LSU's got this pile of money from their collective. They all have collectives now, right? And they're allocating them to their stars. I have no idea, but I suspect that Angel Reese's marketability when she goes to the WNBA absolutely plummets. It essentially falls to zero when she's the, I don't know, the 15th best player in the league. I think Caitlin Clark might be kind of a unicorn in all this, and that she might be the top and WNBA player next year. I mean, she's an interesting player to watch. Do you agree?
I agree. I think she's one where it feels organic with her. It doesn't feel like ESPN's pushing women's sports. It feels like she's a true star that's organically driving a lot of attention to her team, to women's basketball, from people like and states other than Iowa, people in Alabama that I know, people in Georgia that I know, saying, hey, have you seen this Caitlin Clark girl? Did you see the highlights? She dropped 44.
Okay. And so beyond the shooting is freaky. Okay. It's great. What do you think of her personality?
To be honest, Mike, I know very little about her personality. I haven't seen, she clearly is a competitor. I can see that when I'm watching her, but I haven't seen her on TikTok. I haven't seen her express herself and the way that we see with a lot of these NIL characters, kids that are trying to make money. She seems fully focused on the sport, on the game, more of a Kobe Bryant than a Michael Jordan.
Her workout videos are the opposite of like Luka Doncic's, right?
impressive, you know, is what you're saying.
Yeah, they're crazy. They're crazy impressive. But I think there's always this weird political aspect to women's sports. I think she's delightfully weird. So I think she ends up kind of being, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but she's kind of different. The facial expressions, the way she conducts herself, the intensity. Mm-hmm. And so I think she is a interesting personality from a marketing perspective that actually has the ability to, if marketed correctly, avoiding the Gronk thing where they make her, out to be something sort of terrible. But yeah, I mean, she's probably the first legitimate, how do I say this, personality to come out of women's basketball, perhaps ever. And I'm probably going to take some heat for that.
Yeah, I will just say about her, she seems authentic. And that's kind of what I was touching on with the lack of a TikTok presence. Or I mean, I don't know if she has it, but I just, anything I've seen from her on television, on social media, has just been her being her. Her being a great basketball player, her training really hard. And so there's not that fabricated stardom that we see nowadays with a lot of these TikTok stars coming as college athletes. And I appreciate that. I respect her as an athlete. I'm more likely to pay attention to her. And I think if you compare her likability to, say, the U.S. women's national team last year, I have to imagine she's a much more universally appealing figure.
So far,
in spite of the fact that she's not representing the country. And so I think that there is value in her in terms of marketing. I could see her being the face, being the Gatorade spokesperson, being the Subway spokesperson, carrying those torches that have been carried by Olympians, by men's professional athletes, and kind of being the female face of it.
But Doug, and here's the crazy thing about this, the thing that people want to ignore. Do they actually, what athletes actually move product, right? And so Caitlin can be likable. Different athletes can be likable.
Yeah.
Do they actually change behaviors? And so we're always going to come back to Michael Jordan. I'm sure, though it's before you were born, I'm sure you've seen enough of the videos. He had this smile, right? This kind of electric athleticism. It was perfect to the point where the classic tagline, right, of be like Mike.
Yeah.
Right. So how many athletes really inspire that kind of be like X? And it's a very small group. So.
And I think the difference in a Caitlin Clark versus, say, a LeBron James, who, I mean, it's kind of an unfair comparison because of the scale of LeBron's fan base, but LeBron probably has a bigger anti-fandom than fandom. And that's always interesting to me with things like Nike, things like Gatorade, where half the people watching the ad are actually have a negative association with the spokesperson, with the player. And Caitlin Clark's still in a place where she doesn't have that. And so she has that going in her favor. Again, I mentioned LeBron James and the U.S. women's national team as well, where certainly there's a negative connotation for a lot of folks. And she's still in that. The second she becomes an advocate in any direction for something political, that changes. And so it'll also be interesting to follow her career and see how much she stays in the lane that she's in right now, or if she stays in the Michael Jordan Republicans buy sneakers too kind of mindset, or if she drifts from that, and because we don't know what she's like, we don't know what she stands for, what's important to her, and we'll find out in the next couple of years. I would imagine by the time she's in the WNBA or representing the U.S. at any level in the Olympics, that I start to find those things out.
Well, and then the challenge will be when she goes to the WNBA is, does the coverage follow her, right? So right now,
I think the answer is yes, given that the coverage of the WNBA already exists more than Major League Baseball.
But what if she ends up in, and I don't know what the worst market is in the WNBA.
There's only like eight of them. So,
yeah. So, you know, the WNBA has clearly tried to build this kind of homage to the Lakers and the Celtics, right? Between the Aces and the Liberty. So if she gets buried on a bad team, will we essentially forget about her? Because to try and keep the hype machine rolling, and this is going to be the challenge for a lot of women's sports, to try and keep it rolling when you're kind of trying to buy the demand, sort of buy the community spirit or buy the hype, rather than sort of have the fandom drive it organically. It's going to be really a fascinating thing to watch for the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the by the fan, because it's not just women's sports to me. I've seen that with like any kind of startup league, the XFL, the USFL. We've seen that with those football leagues where I've been to games and it feels like they're doing all kinds of gimmicks. They're pulling every trick out of that, out of the bag, trying to win over your fandom, trying to buy it. And even if it costs money, even men's college basketball at a school like Georgia, where I attended, clearly a lot of football passion, not a ton of enthusiasm regarding a sport like basketball when the teams are struggling. They would give away so much free stuff to get people. I mean, it was a free pizza, a free t-shirt, a free jersey. Every time you walked in that stadium, you were getting something for free. And I was always like, how much are they spending to give away like thousands of these things every single game when they play 30 games a year here? And I think that a lot of teams that aren't the NFL and that aren't the major college football or college basketball blue bloods are in that position where they are somewhat buying fandom and playing the long game, hoping it's going to pay off. I think the WNBA has certainly been in that role.
Let me say something really aggressive. It's because the fandom's fake. I mean, yeah. The bottom line is the fandom is fake, right? Fandom is that there's generations of memories, and whether you saw it or you watched it on NFL films or you heard about it from your parents or your grandparents. And with a new expansion league, right, this is the thing. Oh, I'm a big fan of the Birmingham. What was the Birmingham USFL team? Birmingham Stallions.
The Stallions. Before that, we had the Birmingham Iron. The Birmingham Iron were in the other league. I don't remember what it was called.
It's completely fake, right? It's a manufactured community of fans. There's no tradition. The uniforms, the colors, yeah, I mean, they might be appealing. But I don't have any memories of Terry Bradshaw winning Super Bowls in the 1970s associated with that. And that's the issue with all these expansion leagues and stuff that is trying to be built from the ground up. These are generational builds. But no one has time for a generational build anymore, right?
Yeah, and no, I think the question becomes how do you achieve that organic fandom? I think like the Oklahoma City Thunder did a relatively good job. That was a weird one, not a great market. It was pretty quick. I mean, partially because they had great players. They were in the playoffs a lot of those early years with Durant, Westbrook, Harden. But it seems like they built a long-term fandom really quickly. There's very few franchises that I feel that way about.
Now, they were an NBA franchise, right?
Right, yeah.
Who was coming with some star power. But I it's a point well taken. Locally here, the Atlanta United was fascinating, right? Because it was an MLS team that right out the gate was setting attendance records. You talk to someone from Europe and they're like, what do you mean they got 60,000 people? We don't get 60,000 people for a soccer or a football game. But again, it was sort of artificial, right? They programmed in songs and chants and it's just about a bunch of people.
They kind of faked it till they made it. It was like artificial until people kept coming and kept showing up, and now they have these memories of winning a championship and have these hopes and expectations and shared experiences and community.
But shallow, right? It's only ever going to be as deep as the last few years. So, okay.
Totally fair. Yep.
Okay, Doug. So moving to college football. Okay, I every season in college football is fun. Let me give you, I'll give you my top five things that I potentially want to talk about, and you can choose which one we talk about, or you can choose the order or which ones we ignore. Okay, so on my mind, the Jimbo buyout. Kind of fail at your job and walk away with $75 million.
It's the American dream. Number
two, yeah, it sure is. The Harbaugh suspension. He can still coach the team, just can't. I guess he can go to the games via Zoom or something. Colorado, 1-6 in conference, 4-6 overall.
Good.
Georgia, Alabama, meeting again in the SEC championship. I don't understand. Can you really leave either of those teams out of the college football playoff?
Can't if Alabama loses.
The thing that makes that complicated is there are five undefeateds in college football, and we're going into week 11. Five undefeateds. It's an interesting season.
I think it's going to work itself out because you look at Michigan, Ohio State's the obvious one. They're going to play each other. Georgia and Alabama are going to play each other, and that won't necessarily eliminate both teams. Bama potentially, I mean, both teams could potentially be eliminated just depending on the circumstances. I think Washington and Oregon, if I remember correctly, they'll end up playing each other again in that championship, which should eliminate either loser. Florida State's got the easiest path.
Okay.
And yet they seem vulnerable still.
Okay. Now, I mean, you're a bit of a homer. You're a complete homer. But Georgia's the interesting one to me in all this, because if they're not four undefeateds and Georgia loses to Alabama, I don't see how you cannot let the defending champion, who would have lost one game. I mean, Georgia's record is getting to the point where it's fairly historic.
Yeah.
If the Bulldogs lose in the SEC championship on sort of a semi-neutral field, right? I don't think you can leave them home. But it almost seems like you look at the college football predictor and some of the media, and it's almost like you almost get the feeling that this is the year the Big Ten kind of pushes for two teams.
No way.
Okay.
No way. I don't think the Big Ten. I don't think a one-loss Ohio State or one-loss Michigan. No way. I don't think that. I think that the scenario where Georgia gets left out.
Michigan loses without their head coach, who is later cleared.
That's on him. That's on him for the whole thing. I know Stephen A. has been outspoken about Michigan. Even if they go undefeated, shouldn't be allowed in. I'm not going to speak to that. But I will say, if they lose a game, they lose a game. It's fair and square. I think the scenario where Georgia gets left out is Alabama beats Georgia in any fashion. 1 point, 40 points. Alabama beats Georgia. We'll say Ohio State beats Michigan, whatever. That could go either way. We'll say, I don't know, do we put undefeated Washington? That knocks Oregon out. Undefeated Florida State. And there you go. There's your four teams. Georgia's number five. So I was listening last night to a couple of former Georgia players, Aaron Murray and company, Sean Marino, Tavares King, and they were saying, like, yeah, I think that's probably how it should go down. If Georgia loses. So essentially, like I said last week, Bama has almost zero repercussions for losing to Texas in that scenario.
So Bama in and Georgia be out. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm not saying I just think that people get tied up in these theoreticals that leave out arguably the best team every year. And then Florida State will lose to Florida, and like a million things will happen between now and then because it's college football and crazy stuff happens and nobody's really that good. And I was looking at ESPN's prediction for the college football rankings, and they had, I think they had Louisville number 9. Louisville almost lost to Virginia this week. Virginia, with someone who has plenty of family members who are alumni there, I've kept up with them to some degree, not a good football team. And so the fact that Louisville's number 9, it's like, okay, the top 8 teams are the teams that have a shot. And several of them are going to play each other. And I don't know. I think Georgia's going to be number 1 in the college football playoff this week because of what they did to Ole Miss, who was a top 10 team going into last week. And then I think they're going to, I do think they end up in a position where they can, if they beat Tennessee and Georgia Tech, as everyone expects them to, I think they'll be in a position like they were in 2021, where they win their number 1 seed, they lose, they're the number 4 or the number 3. But they're not going to fall out. I think that things will shake out that way, but there are plenty of scenarios where that doesn't happen, where they get left out. And one thing that's interesting about this Georgia team is a lot of the Georgia fans feel like, oh, we're not as good as we used to be. I'm kind of one of those guys. That's not to say they can't win at all, but the media talks about them as if the last 3 years in this team are the same team. So they'll say they've gone 38-1 in their last 39 games or something like that. And so they do have this major advantage over, say, Alabama, some of these other teams fighting for a spot or that might get left out at the end, where it's like they've played an extra 15 games in the minds of so many people, where it's like they were 15-0 last year, and then they lose one game after going 12-0 this year. Like they shouldn't be penalized or they shouldn't be left out. It's still their championship to defend. And so it's not totally objective in terms of the past.
Let me make a statement that you can react to. Okay. And look, I understand the past is the past. A lot of these guys move on to play on Sundays. But you look at the scale of some of those victories over the last couple of years in the playoffs against Michigan and against TCU. And I can't help but think, and again, look, it's not even just this issue of recency bias in terms of these teams have been better. There's a lot of carryover on these teams. There's a lot of kids that were still that played in that sure. game last year, yep. still yep. on campus. And so I can't help but think that based on what I've seen this season and last, that probably Alabama and Georgia are the two best teams in the country, and it may not actually be that close.
So I was actually about to go there, Mike, because the narrative this year, especially with the way these teams started the season, the narrative has been that it is a down year for the SEC, and this is the year that someone else has a shot. It could be Texas. It could be Michigan's year. It could be Ohio State's year. It could be Washington or Oregon out of the Pac-12. I mean, it's totally wide open. At one point, we were talking about USC. Shoot, at one point, we were talking about Colorado. It felt like a wide open year. And we're back in a position where you look at it, you watch these teams play late in the season, and you do get the sense that Georgia and Alabama are head and shoulders above everyone else. Or to put that differently, you get the sense that if you're Washington, you want Georgia out. And then you don't want to have to play Alabama. And then you hope Alabama gets upset. And so you start to look at it through Washington's eyes, through Oregon's eyes, through Texas, Texas is probably the one that feels the most confident. But if I'm a Texas fan, I don't want to rematch with Alabama, and I sure don't want to play Georgia either. And so I think that regardless of the narrative being that this is a down year, I think both these teams are peaking at the right time. They're playing their best football late in the year. They have the most talent of anybody. That's well documented through recruiting. And as much as people hate to admit it, those are probably the two best teams in college football right now. And the thought of leaving a one-loss Georgia out feels wrong based on what they've accomplished and the team that they have. With Alabama, I think everyone will feel like they dodged a bullet if they get knocked out. If Georgia beats Alabama, I think everyone, there will be a huge sigh of relief amongst Georgia fans, amongst Michigan fans, amongst, you know, whoever's in, because that's not a team you want to play in the playoffs. Not with the way they've been playing. And that they will deserve to not be in because of the season they had, but everyone knows they're a top four team at this point in the season, the kind of football they're playing.
Okay, fair enough. Related to talent, bringing in talent, these college football buyouts are going off the charts in terms of strangeness. Jimbo Fisher's buyout is something in the 70 millions. Who's the, sorry, name?
Mike, what's my buyout if I start messing up the edits on the podcast?
Less. Mel Tucker's buyout, and I don't know how much of, you know, Michigan State is going to try and claw back for moral turpitude or whatever they want to call it, was something in that kind of range as well. And so are these standard deals for a hot coach successful at the Power 5 level in the $100 million range? It's a bad look. And this is the kind of stuff that I think continually puts pressure on the notion that the players should be reclassified as employees, at which point I think the whole house of cards outside of some elite set of schools in the SEC and the Big Ten, that it just starts to collapse. You turn the players into employees, and I think the University of Illinois is essentially finished in college football.
I don't know, but I do envy the position of these head coaches who get enormous extensions if they win and enormous buyouts if they lose. Quite the enviable job. I mentioned earlier the American dream. And it's almost to a point where if it's purely financial, if we're operating as purely rational, financial, non-emotional creatures, you're almost incentivized to be that coach that loses and gets paid $75 million to live on the lake for the next 5 years or however long his contract is. Versus working overtime and recruiting 24/7 and never seeing your family. It's kind of crazy that that's the world we live in. That's what's been negotiated by these agents. That's kind of the standard precedent to be able to hire a coach at that level for a school like Texas A&M, schools like Alabama, often in that position. And so it's always fun, the coaching carousel this time of year. You start to see guys jump around and big splashes or kind of some questionable moves in terms of what schools hire who or whatever. But it seems like the schools that pay the big buyouts, they tend to do it over and over again. They tend to, I think about Auburn, they've done it 5 times, it feels like, in the last 10 years. Pay a guy a lot of money, extend him by way too much, pay his buyout, get the next guy. You're still paying the last guy's buyout by the time you sign the next guy. And so Texas A&M, I won't be shocked if they're in that position. And to the point of NIL and the transfer portal, Texas A&M had the number one recruiting class, I think, 2 years ago. They beat Alabama and Georgia for a lot of kids. And I expect a lot of those kids to go to the next highest bidder and be back on the market as well. And so it's going to be a huge shakeup in terms of talent in the SEC.
Doug, my feeling is that was actually almost what doomed Fisher, is this year when he had 8 5-stars and then didn't convert. That seemed to be what precipitated the downward spiral. I don't know how many of those kids are. Do you know how many of those kids are left on that roster?
They've got a good bit. I watched them several times this year. Their defensive line is loaded with NFL talent. I mean, they're kind of like what Georgia used to be. It's like, we envy the talent they have. I know Georgia wanted a lot of those guys. I know Alabama wanted a lot of those guys. A lot of good talent at receiver. I mean, they're stacked. It's just, they didn't get the job done. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen a team win the national championship on signing day and become a complete train wreck on fall Saturdays. And Georgia had those teams. That class with Justin Fields in it, highest ranked class. He was the highest ranked player in Georgia history, highest ranked class in school history, I think of all time for any school at the time. And as a fan, you felt like, we're about to have a dynasty. We're about to win 3 or 4 championships. And 2 years later, your top guy Fields is gone. Top offensive lineman Cade Mays is gone. I mean, the top pass rusher transfers to Florida. You're kicked off the team, transfers to Florida, Brenton Cox. Those 5-star heavy classes, I'm not one to say it's not about talent, it's not about recruiting rankings. Clearly it is. You look at the teams that are in the hunt, there's a direct correlation to the recruiting success. But Georgia, for example, they've been like a top three. They've been like 2 or 3 the last couple of years in recruiting. The years when they were number one, they were not even making the playoffs. And so there's a balance of finding kids that want to be there, that are team players. And Texas A&M seemed to attract the kids looking for the highest bidder that were all about me guys, and they got 80 of them and they were stacked, but it did not translate to winning football, winning culture. And yeah, I mean, it's what put the nail in the coffin for Jimbo Fisher, because not only does he have this challenge of handling these egos, but he's got these sky high expectations of winning national championships, competing with Alabama. And it's not a sustainable method of success, but financially it seems like it is.
Well, look, it's institutionally, you look at some of this, and A&M did something very smart by leaving the old the Big 12, to move to the SEC first, which I think essentially catapulted them, or at least temporarily moved them above Texas in terms of the local hierarchy, right? It's like, well, you can come play in the SEC, the top level of college football, but with Texas coming in, suddenly, look, one of the things that probably helps Georgia out, and this is a little, people could push back on this because recruiting is national, but it's hard when there's two programs in your state. And so the Ohio States and the Georgias that are the top dogs in these big football states do have a natural advantage. Down in Florida, you cross that state line and suddenly Florida's fighting with Florida State in Miami, and it's hard to maintain that level of excellence. You mentioned, make the transition, you mentioned Justin Fields. Okay, Doug, so the class, the quarterback class, wow, they've fallen apart, haven't they?
They sure have.
Mac Jones, Patriots. Zach Wilson, 5 touchdowns and 6 interceptions. His coach kind of almost just shaking his head at the fact that he keeps playing him. Trey Lance off the field. Justin Fields injured. But in terms of touchdown to interception ratio, I love that ratio as a stat. He actually was ahead of Trevor Lawrence. 11 touchdowns and 6 interceptions versus 9 and 6 for Lawrence. I still think Lawrence is a legit top 10 NFL quarterback guy, when maybe even more upside to that. But that class, and I sort of go to this because I want to talk about the next year's class as well, the current class, an absolute disaster at this point, right?
It's a train wreck. It seems like that might be consistent for most years where we expect to have you just look at the player comparisons on any draft night and they'll say this guy, even if it's a modest one, Philip Rivers. Okay, they act like every draft has 8 Philip Rivers. You'll be in the 4th round. They'll say this guy comps to Philip Rivers. This guy comps to Alex Smith, a successful franchise quarterback for a long time for various franchises prior to his injury. Those are the conservative ones. And so that's kind of like the floor for everybody. And then you hear these sky high. This guy reminds me of Joe Montana. This guy reminds me of Peyton Manning. This guy reminds me of, you hear it all night long on draft night. And so every fan base has those expectations for those guys. And the media, of course, loves to play into that. And the reality is, on any given year, there might be 20 quarterbacks in the world who are capable of playing at a acceptable level in the NFL. And there might be 10 who are capable of playing at a remarkable level. And yeah, Everybody else is, and that's in all classes. So that's spanning 10 years of drafts. So then you're looking at one guy a year and maybe two guys a year that are serviceable.
Yeah. And so look, I look at this year's class and I can't help but think about you as I'm watching Red Zone yesterday and I'm watching the Giants. And I hear the name DeVito, Tommy DeVito, I believe.
New York legend.
Well, fighting Illini legend. Okay.
He lives with his parents.
That's perfect. I love
Tommy
that.
Tommy DeVito starts for the New York Giants, lives in his childhood home, lives with his parents. He doesn't have to cook meals. He comes home to mama's cooking. She makes up his bed for him. She does his laundry. He can fully focus on football. One of the great stories in the NFL this year. I remember watching the preseason and saying, hey, he's one of those guys, if he ever had any level of success, they would definitely make a movie about him. And I'm not saying he's going to have any level of success or that he has had, but I kind of enjoy seeing him out there.
I wish more data was available, right? Because cracking the code on quarterback drafting is something I would almost love to devote the next couple of years to, right? It's just the data out there, it's just not good enough. There's not enough fine grained detail to really get in. Like I saw one of these, I think it was on Instagram, but this little social media post showing Joe Burrow's decision making, right? And it was like, it was fairly incredible. And you don't know how much of this they're making up on the back end of he spins out of this way. He looks at this receiver. He looks at that receiver. But, truly a remarkable athletic mind, at least. In contrast, right, I think they've gone away from the Wonderlic and they've got some new test. And one of the things that C.J. Stroud took some hits on was that he didn't test well. And so the question is, what kind of test do you need to get at on-field processing of information? And it seems like the NFL has not invested in enough into finding that test. CJ Stroud at this point, Doug, 15 touchdown passes, 2 interceptions. He might be having a top 5 or higher rookie season in the NFL.
I think that he's definitely a Pro Bowler this year. And there's talk about MVP candidacy for this guy as a first year quarterback on a bad team. That is remarkable. And for a guy who decision-making was the knock on, it's like, yeah, where are they coming up with this? Because you watch him play last year at Ohio State. You watched him in the playoff last year. Decision-making was laser fast. And so are they measuring something else is my question. And I think the answer is yes. Are they having him take the SAT and saying, well, or the ACT. He got an 18 on the ACT. Andrew Luck got a 32. And so this guy's a bad quarterback. You would almost imagine if they put some kind of VR headset on him and had him process, go through reads and find the open guy, he would probably score out really, really well. That's my bet, because that's often what makes a difference in NFL quarterback decision making.
And that's one of the things that some sort of eye tracking task.
Right.
Right. Because it something's clearly not right, right? And look, we had all this debate going into the season of CJ Stroud versus Bryce Young versus
no debate.
No debate now.
It's almost strange to me, and it was at the time, and I think I hope that I mentioned it on the show. I know I'd mentioned it in various conversations that there was less discussion about Bryce Young going number one. It reminded me so much of Markelle Fultz in the NBA, where it was like the public kind of decided this guy's going to go number one well in advance to the draft. And all anyone ever considered was who was going to go number two. No one considered if maybe the guy that's going number two or three or four or five is better than the guy going number one. From a measurable standpoint, it seemed like Stroud had the edge. And clearly, I think what the knock really was concerns about his decision making and potentially that Ohio State quarterback bias, which we did talk about at the time. Are we dismissing Stroud as a better prospect because of guys like Justin Fields or players who have had even worse careers coming out of Ohio State in that system under Ryan Day, previously Urban Meyer, and Trestle before that? And I probably think there is some truth to it. I think that if Stroud had played at Bama, he's the number one guy. But to Will Levis's defense or Anthony Richardson, I think you say the same thing about them. But Ohio State truly had this negative impact, and it almost makes you wonder if Stroud continues to succeed, if the next semi-dual threat cannon arm kid comes out of Ohio State and doesn't test well on their mental processing tests or whatever it is that Stroud struggled with, does he get a pass? Because, well, Stroud did too. And so there are these biases that come into play from the previous players out of your school, and Stroud was a victim of it, whereas it seemed to me like Bryce Young was a little bit of a champion or a victor in that sense. And now we get to kind of see who's really the number one guy in that class. And I think if you put a poll out, 100% of the votes are going to Mr. CJ Stroud. Yeah, no doubt.
And I think it's just to sum this up, because I think it's important, right, that there are these couple of aspects to this, that like these kind of these biases that are built in of Ohio State quarterbacks cannot transition to the pros, maybe because the Big Ten competition tends to be overrated relative to the SEC competition, perhaps. I think Stroud, if I remember correctly, may have been a 4-star. So he may not have been as heralded as some of these other guys on the list.
Well, Fields and Lawrence had the hype train going since their senior. I mean, Lawrence for years before that, Fields since his senior year, and I think that plays a factor as well.
I think it does too, because it's like it's built in that these guys have been these elite talents forever, and you hear that someone's a 4-star, it's like, well, he must not have been as good as these guys at the top 11 quarterback camp or whatever the meetings were when they all got together for the evaluations. So you've got these biases, but then you've also got this measurement issue where I think you said it very well. They're not measuring what they really need to measure. They've got this proxy, something like the Wonderlic, that might be correlated with mental processing on the field, but it is not nearly highly correlated enough that it actually gets to the ability to essentially almost kind of reaction time, right? And again, I'll make a very dumb example, right? Think about the reaction times of a cat processing threats. Cat can't take the SAT. And so it's a fundamentally different kind of skill set. And they seem to, again, we go back to the class of potentially one solid starter out of these five guys who are really hyped as future Pro Bowlers. And there's millions. Doug, there were millions of dollars in play. Now we're probably about 3-4 years away from the first $1 billion contract extension for an NFL quarterback. So there's an opportunity there.
There certainly is. And I'm still curious to see how Bryce Young does with better talent around him or a better situation. He's clearly not cut out for the team that he's on right now, but I don't know how many quarterbacks would be having success. I said it in the preseason watching them. That's not to say I think that Bryce Young's this great NFL quarterback. I don't know if anyone was going to be successful in Carolina with the offensive line they have, the weapons they have around him. Stroud, a huge surprise. Will Levis, week one, a huge surprise. Came back down to earth a little bit. Still kind of wait and see on him. Anthony Richardson, a guy that got some buzz in the preseason every time he made a cool throw. And you looked at his stat lines and they were never that good. Still the raw talent that he's been, where it feels like, man, if he ever learns how to be a quarterback, he's going to be really good at quarterback. If he ever learns how to be a good quarterback. I know, I understand that sentence didn't make a lot of sense, but neither does the hype on Anthony Richardson. So yeah. And then shoot, I mean, my favorite are the guys that come out of nowhere every year. The last year was Cooper Rush or Brock Purdy. I was hoping Tommy DeVito would be one for the Giants, but it hasn't been the case so far. I think I had a quarterback ranking of, or QBR, excuse me, quarterback rating of like 13 or something this week. But yeah, looking ahead to next year's class, the number one guy, kind of the equivalent to Bryce Young, the guy everyone's chalked as the number one guy for years, is Caleb Williams, who was crying in the crowd last week. As a Giants fan, I'm terrified of my team drafting that guy.
Okay.
Not because of his physical abilities or processing or anything, because of his abilities as a leader of men, because of his maturity. Because it's not a guy I want to root for.
Don't we reach the point where you're almost terrified of your team drafting any of these guys?
Whoever they pick, it's probably the wrong one.
I mean, that there's so much desperation for these quarterbacks that they just lead to these bad decision making.
If you're drafting a quarterback, you're probably reaching. Like 9 times out of 10, yeah, you're reaching.
Because you go back over time and you think of like all these guys that were the top pick. What was it? Carson Wentz the top pick?
And him and Goff were in that same. He and Goff were in that same class.
Mariota, are you?
Mariota, you know, I mean, a lot of hype there.
I mean, they're every
Jameis
year.
Jameis Winston.
Yeah, here, this massive amount of hype. Baker Mayfield. I mean, maybe he's
also when I say that teams reach, like you might hear that and be like, "Oh no, that's where they had the guy projected going." You're reaching. I'm sorry, drafting Bryce Young over Jalen Carter in the season that he's having, the level that he's able to perform at right now. I mean, every year there's like a surefire kind of future Pro Bowler behind a quarterback who ends up not being your starter or not being a Pro Bowler, who's drafted as if he's going to be and paid as if he's going to be a Pro Bowler. And so it's, you think about Sam Darnold, you mentioned Jameis Winston. I mean, that's a reach to me. Drafting a guy that doesn't pan out over a guy who's going to be a perennial Pro Bowler and has like a 90% chance of being that, it's a reach. And I would say, I bet you retroactively, if you graded out these drafts, those top 10 pick quarterbacks, probably at least 75% of them aren't graded out as a top 10 player. Probably more like 90%.
And you just wonder if the bias, when you get through the bias and you think about the opportunity costs of what might have been in terms of offensive and defensive linemen and trying to draft that franchise quarterback or that mid first round quarterback. Look, Doug, I mean, I got no idea. CJ Stroud looks very real, but you know, if Will Levis became the best quarterback if Will Levis ended up being the best quarterback, I know we've had some fun with him because of the banana and the mayonnaise, that it wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me at all that this stuff is just so hit or miss at this point that also, there's probably a better strategy.
Would it not surprise you if some kid drafted in the 5th round ended up being the 2nd best out of this class? It seems like that happens half the time.
Brock Purdy, right? Not at all.
Yeah,
Tom Brady.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the reality is, you almost wonder if there's a numbers game in all this. And is the sweet spot, you draft 3 4th-round quarterbacks and you never try and you draft a 4th-round quarterback every year and you never draft a quarterback in the top 10.
I think that the Packers are the closest we've seen to that. Not 4th-round guys, but maybe late 1st-round. Jordan Love. I don't know when Aaron Rodgers was picked, but they had Brett Favre on the roster. Their draft, and the Patriots did that for a while. While Brady was on the roster, they were drafting Garoppolo. They always had a guy. Hoyer, they were always bringing in quarterbacks they thought had potential and maybe even trade value. Shoot, the Packers did it with Matt Flynn during the Aaron Rodgers reign and ended up trading him away for a hefty value. And so I think that's a strategy we've seen and has worked relatively well for those teams. Of course, Patriots never did find their successor to Tom Brady, although you could argue that Garoppolo was that guy and they traded him. I guess the time will tell with the Packers, with Jordan Love, that whole strategy beyond Aaron Rodgers. I still didn't love that one, but we've seen a version of that strategy. But we've also seen a lot of teams tank year after year after year, and at least 50% of the time take a quarterback in the first round, see what happens. I wouldn't be shocked to see the Cardinals do that. Couldn't you see the Cardinals going from Kyler Murray to Caleb Williams?
Oh, I think it's just about time that you're going to see them move on from him. I think that's almost – look, Doug, I mean
– but couldn't you see them going from like Kyler Murray to another Kyler Murray? Kyler Murray 2.0. That's
and then the bias is built into this. It's the Arizona Cardinals. Tyler Bagent versus Justin Fields. I mean, if you're a Bears fan, don't you look at this at this point and kind of go, I don't know who's going to win more games for us if they start for us next year. That you truly
it's
have
also nobody. Like Zappi in New England against Mac Jones. Mac Jones kind of heralded as the next Tom Brady at one point, and of course Zappi maybe making some bad decisions late this week. But nonetheless, it seems like really, if you take draft, if you view the draft position as a sunk cost, it seems almost neck and neck with guys like Zappi and Mac Jones. Or the whole situation in Chicago. And again, that's what I'm saying. These top 10 pick quarterbacks are typically a reach. And well, yeah, you're lucky if you have – I have some friends – I have a friend that's a Chargers fan, and that's a pretty long-suffering – the couple of Chargers fans that there are, they're a long-suffering group. They always feel like they should be better than they are. But I always look at it like, dude, you got one of the guys that actually panned out at quarterback. Yeah, the rest is easy. Like, you just got to have good coaching and – a couple good acquisitions and build around that. But for the teams that are stuck in a cycle of drafting first round quarterbacks and waiting 3 or 4 years to see if they can turn the corner and then doing it again and again, that's a pretty miserable fan experience.
Doug, the one that should take more heat that they don't for a variety of reasons. One, they're winning, and two, they found a guy in the seventh round is the 49ers selection of Trey Lance, right? Because you realize you got to go back to how little data was available on Lance playing in a lower division. And in fact, barely playing. That was in some ways an outrageous pick.
My favorite part of that whole thing is that the biggest argument that football fans spent way too much time discussing was whether Trey Lance or Justin Fields was the better option, and felt like that was going to make or break a lot of GMs' careers. And as it turns out, it might have been wrong to draft either of them.
Okay, moving on to popular culture. Two stories from popular culture. Okay, they are clearly just working it. The Kelce Swift romance. Something comes out every week, and I think that's very suspicious. So he flew to Buenos Aires and was somehow photographed backstage. Okay, you can say whatever you want to it. The other thing that's come out, and again, this is now totally outside of the realm of sports, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is on life support, Doug. The Marvel's movie has came out. And the number I saw, I've seen two different numbers. One, $110 million on a $250 million production budget. But I've also seen an estimated $47 million domestically. Okay. So again, the life cycle of fandom is something we don't really talk a lot about of this. The great thing, look, sports, the great thing about the life cycle of a sports fan is it goes on forever, right? When was the first time you wore a Georgia jersey? When did mom put that on you?
Probably in the crib, but
okay.
I'm not talking about Georgia. The house. Georgia what?
The hot one. Yeah, it's in the crib. Gotcha. Okay. So from age 1 week, mm-hmm. and you're going to be a Georgia fan till the day you die, and hopefully the mid to late 80s. We'll give you guys. You look right. like you got a life. Okay.
I hope so. Yeah.
In other entertainment categories, it can be a very short window. And so the Marvel Cinematic Universe was interesting in that they kind of had it rolling for, I don't know, about 10, 15 years. But it seems like they have now, they're driving that into the ground with product that has no appeal to their core. And it's there's interesting fandom stories here, right? You look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe fandom, they're giving a product that these people don't want. They seem to be giving a product that they think they should want. Mm-hmm. They don't listen to their fans. And is it actually something that's even recoverable at this point? I mean, look, fans are very forgiving. Nebraska football fans, they win 10 games 1 year. They're all back in. Maybe Marvel fans are more resilient. Or are we seeing essentially the death in real time of what has dominated movie box offices for, like I said, 10 to 15 years?
If you could have shorted the Marvel brand 10 years ago, I would have gone all in, because they do these conferences, I guess those kind of fandom conferences. Star Wars, they do the same thing where they get out together and they talk about future projects. And I remember Marvel, they'd gone through Iron Man, gone through Captain America. They'd gone, I mean, all the big.
Let me be the fan. Yay, Captain America.
Yeah, Iron Man. Yay! And then it got where they're like, Ant-Man? And you're like,
maybe.
Yeah, like, I don't know. But then it just kept getting, I remember even Doctor Strange being like, who is Doctor Strange? Like, why would I care? How is he cool? Like, Iron Man's cool. How is he cool? And then it kept getting more obscure until it's like, are they making up these characters? Or are these just failed comic books that
never
got any traction?
Or about 6 months ago, I saw a Marvel movie called The Eternals. I have no idea. Not a single.
Are those new? Are they new characters? And I'm sure there's some fanboys that are like, these guys don't know what they're talking about. And you're right. We don't. Yeah. I don't know anything about these guys and why they earned. Like, usually when they make a movie, it's because of it was, and it's an adaptation. It's because it was a successful original, right? Like Lord of the Rings. Those books are bestsellers. Let's make a movie. But Iron Man, huge built-in fandom. They already sell the toys. People already wear the costumes. Let's make a movie. The Eternals.
Incredibly talented actor as well, too, right? With a ton of appeal.
Oh, he was playing himself. He was playing himself. But, yeah, and then you get to some of these. And I can't even tell, like, the Marvels, Miss Marvel, I didn't know she was a thing. And I don't know who these other two women are. And I don't know any of the upcoming movies. I have no familiarity with these characters. They seem irrelevant. It feels like the B-sides to albums. It feels like if they were like still releasing Beatles albums, but like, hey, these are the ones we passed on the first time because they weren't good enough to be on the album, but we want to milk as much money out of that project as we can. So we're releasing it now. That's what Marvel's become.
Does it also feel like, hey, we know you love these characters. You spent a lot of money. You went to 17 movies to see how this all fit together. Unprecedented, right?
Yeah.
We're going to stop doing that stuff because, well, we don't actually have any reason why we're going to stop doing that stuff. We just feel like you should go over and watch this stuff.
You should watch
this stuff. It's crazy. I mean,
it's equally complex. And so you have to watch, like, you have to be very invested to know what's going on. Which, by the way, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sorry to go back to this. This is the formula they're using for Star Wars right now. They're looking at, hey, yes. Marvel was a big success. Let's do the same thing. And we're all seeing how it ends at the same time with Marvel. And it's like, okay, this isn't going to end well. Like, they're building toward this mega movie, like TV mashup with Star Wars where all these character stories intertwine and they all end up. And it's the same thing. It's the Avengers. And it ends with movies about the Marvels and,
well, does it end with
$47 million in the box office on a $200 million budget?
Does it end with these properties being sold off from Disney as Disney undergoes a radical reorganization and these end up being sold off to companies that are interested in making kind of the fanboy creators that want to make content for the other fanboys. And I use those words intentionally.
I hope that's what happens. That would be fantastic. Shoot, I would be glad if Apple, I would be glad if Netflix, I would be glad like in pretty much anyone else's hands but Disney for a franchise like Star Wars based on how it's been handled and the trajectory that they're on. And the fact that it seems like this whole thing with Marvel and they're kind of crumbling, it's not like it's an accident. I mean, it was mapped out 10 years ago. This is what we're going to do. We're going to introduce all these characters and all these stories, and we expect them to perform at the same level of the characters that you love and are invested in. And that's what we're going to do for a decade.
I know this isn't your strategy, but why was there no one in the room that would say, why? Right? Why would they perform at the same level?
Got outvoted. But yeah, there's, I mean, it's a pretty simple like fandom. Yeah. example that people aren't, you had this old quote that I made into a social media like short saying that nobody owes fandom to anyone for anything. Like I don't owe it to watch NHL games or to pull for a WNBA team or to like, I don't owe it to you. I don't, and I'm not a bad person or I'm not selfish or whatever if I don't do that. Like that's my valuable time. You've got to create something that's interesting to me. You've got to create something that's valuable to me. That's, you know, that I'm willing to not only shell out dollars for, but spend time investing in Marvel. Like I said, you've got to watch all kinds of stuff. Star Wars nowadays, it's like, well, you got to go back and watch this animated kids show. And then you got to watch this other animated show. Then if you watched all 9 movies and then the like 4 other movies or whatever they've made and read this comic and read this post on Reddit, and then you're ready to go and you'll understand what's going on. It's a lot of investment for fans. And so there's the question is, why do they owe it to you to do all that? And they don't. The answer to that is no. And the question is like, okay, what value would that bring them? Would that satisfy them? Would that bring them something that, and to me with Marvel at the end of the day, when you do all that work and then your final product is being able to understand these uninteresting characters doing a lesser version of what the interesting characters did. And it's like, yeah, I give up. I'm not going to keep spending my time and money on this.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that the only real answer, and I don't actually even think this would work at this point, is just the reboot, right? That and look, I don't actually know where you go with Star Wars. They've created that, they've turned all of that into such a complete mess. I almost wonder if, and again, you watch a lot of movies, Doug, so I'll just bounce this off you. The old model used to be, well, we do 3 Batman movies or 3 Spider-Man movies. We go away for 5 to 10 years, and then we launch it again, right?
I think it's worked for Spider-Man. I think it's worked for Batman.
Does that work, though, when you've got 17 or 18 Marvel movies already out there that all were tied in together, and you've built these layers of complexity? I don't know that you can throw that
like
away.
Can they go back and tell the Iron Man origin story with a different actor? And it's tough.
I don't think you can.
Yeah, it's tough. So then it's like, well, they've made the canon and they've made it all somewhat permanent. So now they've got to find other characters that people find interesting. And all anyone cares about is Iron Man, Spider-Man, Captain America. You know, it's just a small handful of interesting guys there. And with Star Wars, the Skywalker family. Outside of that, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of interest in the general public.
Okay, I think this is a good point to wrap up. So as always, thanks for listening. Online home is fandomanalytics.com. Thank you.